Hare Krishna. So we continue with the 17th chapter. Yesterday, okay, some questions? Yeah. Little loudly? Yeah. Is about Muhammad. Now we can see saintly qualities outside the Vedic tradition also in, say, Jesus or in Saint Francis. But Muhammad was a military conqueror and he married many queens, many wives, and one of his wives, Fatima, was very almost like a child when he married her. So this doesn't seem at all. Aisha was. So this doesn't seem to be the characteristics of a saintly person. As I told earlier, that we'll have to close that, I think. That Muhammad combined the characteristics of a Brahmana and a Kshatriya. So Jesus was primarily Brahmanical. As was Saint Francis. Saint Francis was never an administrator. In fact, Saint Francis was so much against any sort of administration that normally when the Franciscan order was formed to help people who wanted to follow in his footsteps, so he insisted that the Franciscan preachers not have any certification from the church, because normally anybody can claim to be a great God-intoxicated person. So the tradition is that if anybody is an itinerant preacher who is being representing the Catholic Church, then they have a certification from the Church. But Saint Francis insisted that, you know, your devotion alone should be your certification. You don't need anything else. And that actually led to a lot of persecution of his preachers, because people couldn't comprehend, because they were not like the normal priests. So the point which I'm making here is that the Brahminical value is often antithetical to administration, especially the saintly Brahminical value. And if Jesus had not been followed by the preaching of the apostles, then whether his preaching would have had much effect is questionable. Similarly, what Chanakya could have achieved without Chandragupta is also questionable. Of course, you can say the other way also. Chandragupta would not have achieved without Chanakya also. But the point is, we need both Brahmanical wisdom and Kshatriya organization. So, instead of comparing Muhammad with saints, it is better to compare Muhammad with saintly kings, Rajarishis. You know, we may not see any Rajarishi marrying a very young girl, but we do see Rajarishis marrying many queens. And polygamy is accepted in all cultures, practically speaking. Polygamy means one man marrying many wives. Technically, it's called polyandry. Polygamy is to have many spouses. So polyandry is to have many husbands. Polygamy is to have many wives. So Kshatriyas did have many wives, and that doesn't make them any less saintly, less any spiritual minded. So, the better framework to compare Muhammad is with Kshatriyas, Kshatriya kings, who also were spiritually minded. And from that perspective, the Kshatriya morality is also slightly different from the normal understanding of morality. In the sense that for the sake of for the sake of a war, even the Pandavas were sometimes required to sacrifice ethics, although they tried to stick to it as much as possible. But when the other side was unethical, they also had to resort to unethical things. So, with respect to Muhammad, there are two radically different perspectives. You know, India has had suffered much due to Islamic fundamentalism, and that has shaped a view of Islam and of its founder as just militantly anti-religious, anti-Hindu, anti-Vedic, and this view often sees them as bankrupt of any spiritual qualities. But that is not the view that our acharyas have given us. So in general, we have the pramanas, pratyaksha, anuman and shabda. So pratyaksha and anuman are valid, but they are not final. The final praman is the shabda. So in this case, if we don't have a direct shabda from the Vedic scriptures, but we do have the statements of Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada consistently refers to Muhammad very positively. He refers to Muhammad more or less in the same breath as he refers to Jesus. The Lord has sent many people for raising the God consciousness of people. And he has sent Muhammad also. Prophet Muhammad, Prabhupada referred him as Hazrat Muhammad. So, this did not stop Srila Prabhupada from acknowledging in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. He does say that so many temples were desecrated. And he calls Aurangzeb as the great Hindu hater. So, Prabhupada does report the facts, but Prabhupada doesn't use those facts as a testimony to indict Islam as a whole. So in general, we have to be aware of the dangers of Islamic fanaticism, but it is the, you know, I earlier talked about typology. You know, we want to make sense of the world, and for that purpose we try to create systems, typologies, analysis. It is like this. So often this is simplistic. You know, Muslims are also a wide variety of there. It's not that every Muslim is a fanatic. And the idea of simplistically painting all Muslims as fanatics, it shows an ignorance of the complexity of human psychology. Now, the basic presumption that we as devotees should have is that Muslims are not Muslims. They are souls. So if we see them more as Muslims and less as souls, that's a problem. And Muhammad's life, if you see it from a Kshatriya's perspective, certainly Muhammad's life you will not see much sadhana, like we call a saintliness, saintly sadhana. But that is generally, none of the prophets in the Abrahamic tradition, they do any systematic sadhana to connect with God. And that is one of the challenges of the Abrahamic tradition, that there is a revelation from top to down, but there is not a systematic process from which to rise from bottom to up. So the prophets are also, in general, men of the world whom God bestows His grace upon. And then that their life gets transformed. You know, Muhammad was born in a poor family and he lived a life of poverty, and then he married a widow who was much older than him, and that's how his fortunes improved. And then at the age of 40, suddenly he started getting revelations. He was a pious person, but he was not a saint pursuing sadhana. So that's why we need to have the proper standards to compare with. So we cannot compare him with a saint. To compare him, Prabhupada, he raised God consciousness. And God consciousness can be raised by saints. It can also be raised by Rajarishis, saintly kings. And the standard of saintly kings is entirely different from that of saints. Now, if we look at how Arjuna was attracted to Subhadra and what all he did to get Subhadra, you know, we would not normally think of Arjuna as a saint, isn't it? At least from that pastime. Now, that doesn't at all seem to reflect na dhanamna janamna sundarim. We would say that, okay, you can look at Urvashi's pastime and how he rejected Urvashi, that refers. But that is not so much a rejection of Nasundarim. It is more of adherence to dharma. Dharmic codes refer that he saw Urvashi as his mother. So, Kshatriyas in general have certain allowances because of the passionate nature that they have and the entanglement with the world, which they have to do as a service. So with that standard, we can see that what Muhammad did was not necessarily non-saintly. Is it clear? Yeah. Yeah, Satyaraj Prabhu. So, what was the destination of Prophet Muhammad? I have not read anything said by Prabhupada. In general, the interactions of our acharyas with Islam have been limited. Now, in Bhaktisiddhanta's time, Islam was more or less in regression. It was Islam was the religion of the lower class of people. The Bhadraloka, who interacted with the British government, they became the influential middle class and the middle upper class, and they were mostly Hindus. And the Muslims couldn't sort of digest the idea that we were rulers of this country and now we have become third class citizens. The first class were the Britishers, the second class were the Bhadralokas. And so Islam was in regression. And that regression sort of expressed itself aggressively in terms of the communal riots that led to the partition of the country. So Srila Prabhupada also, when he preached, the only Islamic country he went to was Iran once. So there's not much interaction between Srila Prabhupada also and Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur also, because it was in regression. There are dialogues with Western scholars who are Christian theologians, but nothing with Islam. And Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur also, as I said, from that time onwards, Islam was more or less in regression. So there are some hypothetical dialogues, non-historical dialogues in his novel Jaiva Dharma. So the statements are limited. That's why we can't say for sure. But from general, what Srila Prabhupada said is that Prabhupada accepted the point that he was a messenger of God. And in that sense, you know, wherever he went was by the will of God, and he would continue his service to God. So Prabhupada does not say specifically that he descended from the spiritual world or that he returned back to the spiritual world. But certainly to be a messenger of God is no ordinary thing. And to that extent, it deserves our respect. In general, we shouldn't let our... There are certain... certain stories in apparently from some Puranas which seem to say that Muhammad was the reincarnation of the demon Tripurasura. So this is a... Whether that is true is strongly questionable, because that has not been quoted by any of the acharyas, and Bhavishya Purana has many questionable things within it. Bhavishya Purana also talks about a Queen Victoria. There is nothing to Queen Victoria, nothing spiritual to about her. So there have been interpolations. As I mentioned, yesterday we were talking about Bible getting interpolated. So even Vedic scriptures have been interpolated. But the point is, the Vedic scriptures which have been central to the Vedic tradition, they have been preserved. The Rig Veda today as it is the same as it was at the time of Yaksha and Shayana, the two classical commentators who were almost like several thousand years ago. Similarly, the Bhagavata and the Gita are also similar. So, as far as no Acharya has written a commentary on the Bhavishya Purana. In that sense, it was not considered so important. Not even Acharya in terms of Vaishnava Acharya, but in general, any scholar has not got any commentaries. So, in that sense, there's a serious possibility that it could have been interpolated. Any other questions? Any reference for? Okay. Can you ask him to close the door of the kitchen? Okay, where is it stated that, say, goodness, ignorance is Shiva, goodness, passion is Brahma, like that? Okay. So, in general, this point about the three Puranas, the three kinds of modes and the three kinds of deities accordingly, this is broadly understood in the Vedic culture. that's a goodness. Those who are in goodness worship Vishnu, and those who worship in passion worship Brahma. The explicit reference for this I have not seen anywhere. Prabhupada says that in his purports many places, but he doesn't quote, as far as I know, any verse for that. But that is widely understood. There are verses which, for example, Lord Shiva is telling in Skanda Puran to Kartikeya that whenever there's a conflict between Sattvic Puranas and Tamasic Puranas, then the Sattvic Purana should be preferred. Shiva Purana Sastreshu, what is the verse? Yes. Yeah, that is natural. Yo yo yam yam tanum bhakta shraddaya architum icchati tasya tasya achalam shraddham tamayo vidadamyam. So Madhvacharya explains that Krishna says, whichever deity you want to worship, I will give you faith. So how he gives faith? One is as a super soul in the heart, but another is by directing them to the corresponding Puranas. So you cannot say that this deity is not very powerful, but please worship him. It will not work like that. If you want people to worship a particular deity, that deity has to be glorified. That is inevitable. See, in general. No. So why does Shiva Puran say that not only Shiva is great, but he is greater than Vishnu or Krishna also? See, yeah, I agree. I understood the question. The point is that the Vedic scriptures are state-specific. State-specific means, according to our state of consciousness, they reciprocate. That is basically a principle of Yetha Mam Prapadyante. As all people surrender unto me, I reward accordingly. That applies not only to the Bhagavad Gita, that applies not only to Krishna, it applies to the Vedic literature in general. So, a Kalpataru means whatever we want, we can get from the Kalpataru. So, if I want evidence for the supremacy of Shiva, I will get that from the Vedic scriptures. If I want evidence for the supremacy of Brahma, I can get even that. If I want evidence for whatever I seek, I can get that. You know, if I want evidence for the supremacy of impersonal Brahman, I can get that also. But if I want to know what is the conclusive teaching of the Vedic scriptures, then I have to look at what is their inner epistemology, what is their inner progression. So, if I want to justify my beliefs in the Vedic scripture will act as a Kalpataru and they will give us whatever we want. So, that way, if we look at the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is written by Vyasadeva in his maturity, after he written all of the scriptures, including Shiva Purana also. And there he says that everything else is Kaitava Dharma. So, that's the first, that's one point about, so first point is they are Yathama Prabhupada. The second is, if you look at it, everything apart from Bhagavatam is Kaitava Dharma. He doesn't use the word, he doesn't say it's false. It is Kaitava Dharma, cheating religion. It's a very strong word. Now, cheating and associating that with religion is not ordinary. So it's indicated that it's religion, it elevates. But it cheats as far as elevating to the highest truth is concerned. So it's not just a partial elevation which is left at that. That partial is presented as if it is the highest. That's what makes it cheating. Otherwise, there would have been no need to use the word Kaitava Dharma. What is cheating? Cheating idea is that what is not the highest is presented as if it were the highest. So, why is that done? That is a part of the Vedic plan to elevate people according to what their desires are. So, what their desires are means that if they want to carry on with their conceptions, then they are allowed to carry on. And Shiva Goswami in the Sandarbhas takes up several of the passages which seem to glorify Lord Shiva. And then he points out one of the things. For example, the Shiva Shastra Shu. Shiva Shastreshu Tadgrahayam Bhagavat Shastra Yogiyat Paramo Vishnurevaikas Tadgyanam Mokshasadhanam Shastranam Nirnayastvesham Tad Anyam Mohanayahi. So Lord Shiva is telling Kartikeya, Shiva Shastreshu Tadgrahayam. Grahayam means to accept. Accept Shiva Shastra Bhagavat Shastra Yogiyat. Bhagavat Shastra means the Shastra about Bhagavan. That is Bhagavatam. Paramo Vishnur Evaikas. Only one supreme is Vishnu. Tadgyanam Moksha Sadhanam. That knowledge is the means to mukti. And Shastrana Nirnayastva Esham. This is the Nirnaya. This is the conclusion of the Shastras. Tad Anyan Mohanayahi. Whatever else is there is Mohanayahi. It is for the purpose of Mohan. Now, Skanda Puran is not a Sattvic Puran. It's a very important point. This is correct. This was from Skanda Puran. Lord Shiva is telling Kartikeya. So, the point here is that Krishna is Yathamam Prapadyante. So, scriptures being a manifestation of his compassion are also Yathamam Prapadyante. And if we just take this quote and battle against that quote, if a person is objective, then you can come to the supremacy of Lord Vishnu. And the Vedic program is that the person, wherever that person may be, that person should be elevated from there. And the idea that the person can be elevated to the highest level in one lifetime is revolutionary. The compassion underlying that is extraordinary. And that is what we have got by the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Srila Prabhupada. So, when this, you see, this is so easy to get. And why do you have to go through all that? But it is not easy to get. It is the mercy that has made it easy to get. Otherwise, even Muktana Pisiddhana, what is the verse? Narayana Parayana Sudurlabha Prashantatma Kotishvapi Mahamune. Parikshit Maharaj is asking Shukadeva Goswami, how Rudrasura is such a great devotee? Because even among the munis, he is such a devotee who is dedicated to Lord Vishnu is so rare. So, how did he become such a great devotee? So devotional service is rare. And the Vedic scriptures have a program for gradual elevation of people. So Shiva Puran is a part of that program of gradual elevation. So in general, those who are devoted to Lord Shiva, if they gradually become purified and elevated, either in this lifetime or the next lifetime, they will eventually rise to the worship of Lord Vishnu or Lord Krishna. You know, in our Ishopanishad classes, you remember discussed about three people who were worshippers of the devatas and they came to the worship of Lord Vishnu. Remember, Vallabhacharya was the worshipper of Lord Shiva. He asked Lord Shiva, what is the best? Give me that which is most dear to you. It's Vallabha's life directly is there. Then he was a worshipper of Lord Shiva. Then he elevated from the worship of Shiva to Vishnu. And then similarly, there's an example of Kesho Kashmiri was a worshipper of Saraswati and he became a worshipper of Vishnu. Krishna, and there is the example of Chandidas, who was a worshipper of Chandi, Kali, and then from her worship, he became a worshipper of Vishnu. So, there are references to this both in scripture as well as in contemporary, in recorded history also. So, we have discussed this elaborately in our Ishopanishad class. I don't think we can go back to this subject right now. So Shastrana Nirnayastvaishas. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita also there is a verse which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu quotes that different people can go on debating about who is supreme. But if one studies the scriptures holistically, one will conclude that Vishnu is the supreme. Ashastra Vihitam Ghoram. तप्यन्ते ये तपोजनः तप्यन्ते ये तपोजनः दम्भाहंकार संयुक्तः कामराग बलान्वितः कर्षयन्तः शरीरस्थम् भूतग्राममचेतसः मां चैवान्तः शरीरस्थम् तान् विद्यासुरनिश्चया. सो हियर Krishna is going to answer Arjuna's question. But the previous verse, what was it saying? Previous verse was talking about these three modes. Goodness, passion, ignorance, how people worship. So now Krishna, in a sense, continues with it, that tamasic form of worship. And he says that there are some people who do tamasic austerity also. And he wants to very clearly differentiate between these tamasic people and the people whom we are going to talk about later. So in a sense, this verse is a sort of backflash to the 16th chapter. 16th chapter talked about those people who defy scripture. And that's why yaha shastra vidhim utsrujya vartate shraddhayanvitaha. That was the question. So now they don't accept shastra, but they have some kind of faith. What happens to them? So Krishna starts with the lowest among that category. Those who not only they don't have faith, but they actually reject shastra. Ashastra vihitam ghoram. So he's telling that there they are ghor. Ghora is brutal or ugly. Tapyante ye tapojana. So the example of this is people like Prakasura. You know, they are doing worship where they are cutting off their own flesh to offer to Lord Shiva. Now the purpose of this is not to so much please Shiva according to some form of worship. It is just to sort of, you know, emotionally blackmail him and get him to come. That is the idea. The modern version of this is self-immolation. Self-immolation means you set yourself on fire. So that is what people do. Suicide is where? Suicide is generally done in public, in private. You just close a door and maybe turn on the fan and hang yourself from the fan or something like that. But when people want to attract attention to a cause and then they burn themselves in public, that is self-immolation. And Buddhists do that very often. Buddhists are the sort of pioneers of that. Because according to their religion, they cannot commit violence against anyone. So even if, say, the Chinese attack Tibet and have taken over Tibet and they are persecuting Buddhism in Tibet, they are religiously prohibited against taking arms. So they say that we will not do violence against others, but they end up doing violence against themselves, which is also in a sense violence. So ashastra hitam gauram tapyante yatapojanaha dambahankara samyuktaha. So it's filled with dambha and ankara. And Krishna is describing all the demoniac qualities that he had talked about earlier. These demoniac people are filled with this kamaraga. And what do they? Karshayantaha sharirastham bhutagrama machetasaha. Karshayantaha. Karshan is, the word itself conveys, you know, karshan, harshness, bitterness. Sharirastham. Krishna says, I am situated in their body and I suffer to see them suffering. So Krishna does not appreciate unnecessary torture of the body. Bhutagramam achetasaha. Although I am there in their body, they are achetasaha. They don't see me at all. Mam chaivanta shariyastam tan vidya asura nishchayan. And they are definitely asuras, Krishna. Nishchayan. So, why is Krishna talking about this verse over here? Generally, we will not think of somebody doing austerity to be demoniac, isn't it? We normally would think of austerity as a religious activity, as a pious activity. And some austerity requires some self-control also to be able to do it. But then, if that is done with the defiance of scripture and with the intention of sort of gaining power by which one can further disrupt the social and spiritual order, then that is the characteristic of asuras. And we see in the Bhagavatam repeatedly, Hiranyakashipu or whichever demon, they all perform austerities and their purpose is demoniac. So, in the Ramayana, there is a story of Shambhuka. Shambhuka was a Shudra who was doing austerity. And when he was doing the austerities, So Lord Ram, he was ruling, and at that time a Brahmin came to his palace and he started chastising Lord Ram and Lakshman, and he said that, what kind of rulers are you? He asked, what has happened? He said that, my son has died. And when my son has died, he said that if the king is virtuous, then nothing disorderly should happen in that kingdom. The king is living according to the laws of God, then the normal order of nature would be followed. And the normal order of nature is the father dies before the son. So he says, I have looked at my life and I have not disobeyed any scripture. I have lived according to scripture. Therefore, the only reason that my son has died must be that something is wrong in the kingdom. And for that, you are responsible. So when Lakshman heard this, Lakshman went and reported to Lord Ram. Lord Ram told him that he had come with his son. So Lord Ram told him, you know, you attend to that that Brahmin and tell him and let his body, that the body of his son, be preserved in a vat so that it will not get decayed. And then he went into his assembly where the sages were there, Narad Muni and the sages. They had come there and he asked them. So Narad Muni said that somebody in your kingdom is doing some severely anti-scriptural activity. So therefore, because of that anti-scriptural activity, this has been the reaction. So you go and stop that anti-scriptural activity, and then the Brahmin son will come back to life. So then Lord Ram went and started searching in all the directions of the kingdom. He didn't find anyone anywhere. Finally, he came to the banks of a river, and there he saw a person doing austerity by hanging upside down. And he looked quite powerful because of the austerity. He was almost looking like effulgent. Then he asked him, who are you and why are you performing this austerity? What is your intention? So he said, I am Shambhuka and I want to perform austerity by which I can go to Swarga and I can become Indra. And he said, I am born in the Shudra family. And Ramayana discovered that as soon as he used the word, I am born in the Shudra family, Lord Ram took out his sword and cut off his head. And it is said that as soon as Lord Ram cut off his head, this Brahmin's son came back to life. So now, this story may seem a little shocking for us. You know, why should somebody be killed for performing austerity? So now, these are the kind of stories which are used by Dalits to sort of say how the Brahminical culture persecuted the lower castes. So, you know, if we have to accept a story, we have to accept it in full, or don't accept it. So, the fact, as it is told in the story, is that there is this Brahmin who had died. If we are just going to see, the problem is that we are living in a particular culture. Ramayana was spoken in a particular culture, and cultural values can be tremendously different. So if we neglect the cultural values and just compare what was done there with what is done here, it may seem radically out of place, but there are some underlying principles that are important. So first of all, if we are going to say that particular killing of Lord Ram, killing by Lord Ram of Shudra, is a justification for the persecution of by Brahmins and kings of Shudras today, or it is the reason why Shudras should protest against Vedic culture, then first of all, look at the full picture. Why only object to that? Now, today, if somebody came to the king and said, my son has died and you are responsible for that, what would the king say? Go to the mental asylum, isn't it? So, what does this point indicate? First of all, it indicates that there is some conception of a deeper order to nature, which we are completely unaware of. And also that order was potent, in the sense that when this Shambhuka was killed, this Brahmin's son got revived. So what does it indicate? That there are principles of orderliness which we don't know about. So when there is dharma being followed, then the kingdom is administered by principles of dharma, and then there are subtler rules and subtler principles also work. So if we want to find out fault with Lord Ram, then we should reject the whole story itself as mythologic. Why should we accept only Shambhuka being killed and not accept the Brahmin's son being killed and Brahmana's son being revived? And if accept this part also, the Brahmana's son being killed and being revived, then we do understand the point that there is something which was right about it. Because when a person is killed and somebody else is revived by that, that means there is some higher power, some higher principle by which this happened. So, if Lord Ram were just blatantly anti-lower caste, if that were his case, then why would he team up with the Vanaras? Why would he be so kind to Guha? So, it's not that he was... There was no question of being just against lower caste for the sake of being against lower caste. The principle was the preservation of dharma. And there are certain principles which are to be followed by people who are in dharma. So, in traditional Varanashram, Shudra, traditional Varanashram means Vedic Varanashram. A Shudra has to do his duties properly, and by that he will eventually become a Vaishya, then he will become a Kshatriya, then he will become Brahman in future lives, and then he will become liberated gradually. Now, if somebody wants to not go through this gradual social evolution, then the path open for that person is the path of bhakti. Even Shudras, an outcast, can practice bhakti and they can go directly back to Godhead. But if a Shudra wants to go to Swarga, there is a gradual progression for that. But when the Shudra refuses to do the Shudra duties and tries to use austerity to sort of gate crash into Swarga, then and to take over the position of Indra over there, then that mentality is essentially the same as the mentality of demons. So now, consider the story of Hiranyakashipu. Now, assume that if before Hiranyakashipu went to perform austerities, now we know in the Bhagavatam that Hiranyakashipu sent the demons to try to disrupt Vedic culture, and the demons were going around and they were destroying yagyasthalis and are doing all that sort of atrocities. So assume that they were not doing that, and assume that we didn't know in advance that Hiranyakashipu was a demon. So Hiranyakashipu is going to the forest and performing austerity, and if at that time somebody goes and, oh, you're performing austerity, kills him off, would that have been wrong necessarily? No. Because Hiranyakashipu, later on what happened? He became such a terrible demon and who caused so much devastation, Lord Vishnu had to appear and kill him. Now Hiranyakashipu, nobody did that because Indra was not potent enough at that time. But Lord Ram was potent enough. So Lord Ram had the responsibility of protecting dharma, and that's what he did. And Brahma generally doesn't kill anyone. Brahma doesn't have a... Brahmastra is not the weapon of Brahma. Brahmaji does not have any weapon only. That so okay. Brahmaji need not have thrown that water. If you go into the specifics of the pastime, we know Hiranyakashipu is Jaya Vijay, and that all that was preparing for the glorification of Prahallad and the appearance of Lord Narasimhadev. So there is a broader context to it. But my point is that from the external perspective, you know, the austerities of Hiranyakashipu and the austerities of Shambhuka, there need not be any difference between them. Both were motivated by ungodly purpose. Just as Hiranyakashipu wanted to take over Swarga, Shambhuka also wanted to take over Swarga. He wanted to attain Swarga and take over Swarga. So in that sense, it is not so much issue of somebody being a higher caste and lower caste. The issue is somebody being godly and somebody being demoniac. And there is a protection of the godly order of society from the demoniac disruption of society. Okay, so, tan vidya asura nishchayan. Krishna is saying that such people are definitely demoniac. That means those who use tapobala to disrupt dharmic order in society. So they are torturing themselves, they are torturing me, and when they get power, they will create suffering for others also. So they are asura nishchayan. Similar. Shiva and Bhasmasura, why did Lord Shiva not kill? In general, the demigods have dual roles. One is as administrator and the other is as a devotee. And as the administrator, they are sort of duty bound to satisfy their worshippers. That means just like there are certain rules by which say, for example, if you go to a shop and you want medicines, if you pay the money, the shop has to give you medicines. If you go, there are you know, the rickshawala says that, you know, I will not go to a particular place. According to many systems of rules and regulations, that's not correct. If a rickshawala is being paid, then he should go to that place. So that way, the demigods in general, if worship is performed for them, then they are to some extent duty bound to give the results. Now that doesn't mean that they don't have free will. They can use their free will and they can say that I will not give. But the principle of say sort of cosmic cooperation is that we give worship and the devatas give results. Devan bhavitanena te deva bhavyantuva. And the purpose of this is parasparam bhavayanta shreya paramavapsyata. It is ultimately meant to be conducive for liberation. But a system of cosmic cooperation is that demigods in general do not use their discriminatory power when they are satisfying their worshippers. So why is that? That could be because of various reasons. One is that, as it is said in the Bhagavatam, when somebody worships somebody, then that person may become a little bit infatuated by that worship. And for that time being, now what Brahmaji says is to Hiranyakashipu, what you have asked of me, what the benedictions that you have asked are very difficult to give. But austerity for my sake will not go in vain. Actually, this should be said only by the Supreme Lord. But then Brahmaji says that, you know, austerity is that you have performed for my sake will not go in vain. And in that sense, he is not right. If you see that the turn of events is a little curious over there. In that seventh canto of Bhagavatam, you study it carefully. The demigods, when Hiranyakashipu starts performing austerity, then the flame starts coming out of his head and that starts heating up the whole universe. The demigods get troubled and they go to Brahmaji. And they tell Brahmaji that actually this person's intention is that he wants to take over your position and he wants to disrupt the universal order, and please do the needful. But when Brahmaji hears and he says, after hearing their petition only, he goes down. But when he goes down and sees the extent of the austerity that Hiranyakashipu has performed, you know, he's done all this for my sake. He gets infatuated by that. And then that is the reason why Brahmaji started. Lord Narasimhadev chastised Brahmaji. He said, you know, don't give benedictions like this. That means that the idea is, in general, the demigods follow sort of, it's like a contract. But when there are demons who are known to be malevolent, then they should not be given benedictions. But sometimes when the austerities are performed, that time the person may just get so caught up. The person for whom the austerities are performed, that person may become so infatuated that person may lose the sense of discrimination, and the demigods, the way they are portrayed in the Bhagavatam, they are not shown as perfect beings. They are devotees, but they get influenced by emotions at particular times. So it can be actually very, you know, somebody starts doing austerities just to please us, it can be very intoxicating. You know, I know one devotee was a brahmachari. He was preaching and then some Mataji got attracted to him. And the Mataji also a devotee. And she told him, I want to marry you. And he said, no, I am a brahmachari. I don't come here. Then he stopped going to that program and he just stopped connecting with her. But then apparently she started fasting. For 6 months she fasted and lost 10 kg weight. Now, of course, this happened in a community where there are all proper counselors and all those things.
But then,
what happened? Well, this dude got emotionally influenced and he married afterwards. So, you know, this sort of so austerity can become a tool for emotional blackmailing. Is it that when the offerings to the demigods are stopped, they become less powerful? There are two aspects to it. It's not exactly that. Sometimes some people say that the demigods are dependent on nourishment. No, that it's that the demigods will star. It's not that demigods will starve if we don't do sacrifices from here. In Kali Yuga, we are not doing sacrifices from people, but the demigods are not starving. And the idea that the demigods will starve if people on Earth don't do sacrifices is like saying that if the Somalian government doesn't pay taxes, then America will become bankrupt. You know, it's an absurd idea. But it is true that there is a system of cosmic cooperation. And in that, the idea is the yajnas are performed, and the yajnas, not they don't so much nourish the devatas. Although in the 7th canto of Bhagavatam it is said like that, all the demigods will become hungry, and then they'll starve, they'll become weak, and then we'll kill them. But Chakravarti Pad Anadyaj explained that, you know, even in the Bhagavatam you have to see who is speaking that. So this is spoken by Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyakashipu is not a Vaishnava Acharya preaching Siddhanta. He is simply trying to goad his demoniac associates on to do their demoniac activities. So that is not an absolute truth that is being spoken over here. It's not the demigods starve because of this, but we will see in that Govardhan Lila, when Indra's yajna is stopped, you know, for Indra it's not a crisis of food, it is a crisis of ego. Isn't it? He thinks, oh, what about my honor? So the idea is, here there is Swarga, here there is Earth, and when both have to adhere to that dharma, even Swargavasis also have some dharma. So when the earthly beings adhere to their dharma, and the swargic beings, the heavenly beings adhere to their dharma, then their whole cosmic evam pravartatam chakram nanu vartayati haya. This pravartatam chakra that is there, Krishna talks about 3.16. So when the human beings don't perform the yajnas, then two things are happening. At one level, those particular yajnas are meant for the demigod. That means that is more for propitiatory purposes of offering respect. It's like say some sannyasi comes to our temple, and then we may, you know, if the spiritual master is coming, we may offer garland and offer respect. If that garland is not offered, it is not that the sannyasi is going to starve. But that garland is an appropriate thing to do, to offer respect and to offer worship. In some places aarti might also be done, some places feet might be washed. So all that is appropriate, and that is by that, you know, that is the way that person should be respected, and that is the way we make spiritual advancement. So similarly, within the codes of dharma, the people of earth have to respect the people of the administrators of the heavenly kingdom. And when they don't do that, at one level, you know, if some sannyasi is not worshipped, that sannyasi is if that person is egoistic, he'll become very angry. Why didn't you worship me? But even if he doesn't become angry, it is we who lose, because we have lost the opportunity for doing dharma and making advancement. So Indra, for him the crisis was that people, his ego was affected. So the system of cosmic cooperation ensures that everybody does their dharma. So the dependence is not so much in a food sense, but in a sense, it is in the sense that everybody has to adhere to dharma for the cycle to go on properly. So let's move forward. Aharastvapi sarvasya trividho bhavati priyaha yajnas tapas tatha danam tesham bhedam imam shrunu. So Krishna will tell now, after he has described at the bottom of this rank, Ashastra Vitam Goram. Now we'll say that, okay, I will describe, if you want to understand what is the level of Shraddha of a person, look at these four activities. Ahara, Yajna, Tapa, Tatha, Dana. And when you look at these four activities, by seeing what kind of activities they are performing, which modes those activities are in, we can understand what is the level of their faith. Then we will start with Ahara. Ayusattvabalarogya Sukhapriti vivardhana Rasya snigdha sthira ridya Ahara sattvika priya. So sattvika priya. So you know, that means if we are in goodness, naturally we will like this. It is not that we have to deliberately choose certain things. Our natural attraction will be to certain things and away from certain things. Rasya Snigdha Sthira. So are you, so what are the characteristics of these food? First you describe their effects. The effect is Ayu Sattva Balarogya Sukapriti Vivardhana. Very beautiful description. Vivardhana means to increase. What all increases? Ayu, the lifespan increases. Then Sattva, one's existence, the quality of one's life improves. Balarogya, it is, gives strength, it gives health. So Ayu Sattva Balarogya are physical effects. And mental effects are Sukapriti Vivardhana. One feels happy and one feels affection. One feels satisfied. Sukapriti Vivardhana. And the characters are Rasya Snigdha Sthiraridya. So they have to be juicy, fatty, enduring, pleasing to the heart. Ridya. So in general, anything can be offered. Anything, of course, means not non-vegetarian food. But any food can be offered to Krishna and that can be said to be prasad. But in general, food also has its moods. And although at one level all food becomes transcendental when it is offered to Krishna, and still at the same time, at a material level, it will have material effects. If I may offer sweets to Krishna, and that becomes prasadam. But if I have got diabetes, just because the sweet that I am taking is a prasad, that doesn't mean that it won't aggravate my diabetes. Isn't it? So, the transcendental effect of the prasad will be at the transcendental level. But the material side of prasad will affect the material level. That's why in general, even in prasad, it's best to eat food that is sattvic. And generally, we don't go about when you get food in the place. Is it sattvic or rajasic or tamasic? We don't have to go about doing that. But over a period of time, we can ourselves see that certain kinds of food, you know, they, we will see in the next one, it might create too much heat, it might create too much passion. It might ignite our desires, or it may make us lazy. So, if we observe that, then we can, as a matter of plan, minimize or avoid those foods. So, Srila Prabhupada writes that even sumptuous food, the food should be good quality, and sumptuous food can be occasional, on festivals or on feast days. But normal food should be nutritious, more than sumptuous. Then now you see the Sanskrit is such a language that there is a figure of speech called onomatopoeia. That means, you know, the sound of the words reflects their content. So if you hear the sound of this verse, you know, Ayu Sattva Balarogya, even if it doesn't know the meaning, it's very sweet. If you listen to the next verse now. Kattuvam lalavana tyoshna. So Tikshna Ruksha Vidahina. So it's like, you know, the sound itself is jarring. So that is the beauty of Sanskrit language. Katuam Lalavana Tyoshna. Lalavana Tyoshna. Tikshna Ruksha Vidahina. Tikshna Ruksha Vidahina. Rahara Rajasyeshta. Rajasyeshta. Dukha Shokamaya Prada. Dukha Shokamaya Prada. So in the previous verse, Krishna described first the effects and then the characteristics. Now he describes first the characteristics and then the effects. In general, when you speak, when we speak or write, the last part of the sentence has the biggest impact. So generally in writing, it is said that whatever you want to linger in the mind of the reader, that you should put last. So then it stays on. So in the first part, Krishna, in this part, Krishna wants to emphasize that actually this food will have this effect. So, dukkha shokamaya prada. So, dukkha is we feel miserable, shoka is lamentation, and amaya is disease. So, all these are the result. And kattva amla launati ushna. So, bitter, sour, salty, ati ushna, very hot. Tikshna roksha vidahina. Pungent, dry, and burning. All these are the foods. So, I think your imagination is active enough to correlate what this food refers to. So, there are some places where the purport is best left unspoken. So let's go to the next one. Yatayamam gatarasam. Yatayamam gatarasam. Puti paryushitam chayat. Puti paryushitam chayat. Uchishtam apichamedhyam. Uchishtam apichamedhyam. Bhojanam tamasapriyam. Bhojanam tamasapriyam. Yatayamam gatarasam. So earlier he had said rasya. Rasya means filled with rasa. But here, gatarasam. The rasa has all gone away. Yatayamam. That means, you know, actually after cooking it is a long time. Yatayamam. Long time has passed. Puti parishitam chayat. So puti means bad smelling. Make you have the word of, what is the putrid in English? You know, and poo. That is the pus that comes out. So it's, all of them have the same root. Parishitam chayat. Ushitam parishitam. It's decomposed. Uchishtam apichamedhyam. Uchishtam means that it is left by others. And amedhyam. Actually, amedhya is untouchable. So all these are foods. Bhojanam tamasapriyam. Srila Prabhupada explained in the purport that what is the purpose of food? It is to increase the duration of life, purify the mind and aid bodily strength. And then he adds, that is the only purpose. Enjoyment is not the purpose. That is the implication over there. So the purpose of life is to increase the duration. Now we may wonder, what do you mean by increasing the duration? Actually, Ayurveda. Veda of the knowledge of Ayu, of increasing Ayu. So we know that in a sense, our life is destined. How long we are going to live in a particular body. So how can Ayu Sattva Balaroge Sukhapriti Vivardhana? How can Ayu be increased? Actually, the number of breaths that we are going to take is fixed. But within that, depending on how we live, if we live in passion, we will breathe faster. And naturally, we will live shorter. And beyond that also, we have some amount of volition. If somebody can end that person, a person can end his or her life by committing suicide. So, the whole principle of Ayurveda is that there are certain things unavoidable in people's lives. But there is much that is avoidable based on this life's actions. So that's why the right choice of food can actually increase Ayu. Srila Prabhupada talks about this even in the purport of the Bhagavatam. What is the verse? About how Kali Yuga is so terrible. First canto verse. No. Nangshatya Ayu Bala Smriti. First canto verse, you know. Prabhupada writes over there, the duration of lifespan has increased because of irregular habits and overindulgence. Nangshantya Ayu Bala Smriti, that's the 12th canto verse. Shorten not so much because of insufficient food, but because of irregular habits. This is which verse? Yeah. Prayen alpa yusha sabhya kalavasmin yuge jana manda sumanda matayo manda bhagyaya padritaha. So 110. So Prabhupada makes this point here. So the purpose of food is to increase the life. And he says the duration of life is shortened not so much because of insufficient food, but because of irregular habits. And by keeping regular habits and eating simple food, any man can maintain his health. Overeating, over-satisfaction, over-dependence on others' mercy, and artificial standards of living sap the very vitality of human energy. Therefore, the duration of life is shortened. So, now going back to this, we will continue about ahara we discussed now. And you can read this purport of Srila Prabhupada. He gives a lot of practical instructions. And we'll continue about the remaining aspects in the evening class. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Gaura Prem.